Well, ladies and gentlemen, I just thought I'd give you this quick Friday update on what I've been doing. So, last weekend, at the time that this video is going out, I was invited to the We Have Ways Festival 2025. Those of you who listen to the We Have Ways podcast may be familiar with it. If you're not, then it is a, well, history festival, primarily centered around World War II, organized by Al Murray and James Holland and their team, you know, the people behind the We Have Ways podcast as well. And it combines reenactors, actual vehicles from that time period, and a series of lectures by various guest speakers on various subjects. And I had a legitimately good time. You know, I finished up having listened, walked and talked all of Friday, running into a fair number of you guys, actually. So if you saw me there, congratulations or commiserations as appropriate. And thank you for coming up and saying hi. And I was there again and all pretty much all day Saturday. Unfortunately, a combination of the weather and a slight family emergency meant I wasn't able to be there on Sunday, but I would definitely like to be there again next year. And I've had all sorts of interesting things. So this, in case you didn't recognise, is an armoured recce unit of the British Army from World War II, which the second oldest of my great uncles was also doing in World War II. Not as part of the unit they're recreating, but they knew an awful lot about the kind of stuff that he got up to. So that was really interesting for me to talk to. And yes, there was naval representation, not as much as personally I would have liked, but hey, I was there as well, so I guess that helps. You'll be hearing more about that in just a moment, including, interestingly, an object connected to HMS Warspite that I was not previously aware of. Food, by the way, was also actually really good, and I say that as someone who's been to a lot of different shows and festivals to do with military history and history in general, and for once I actually felt like I'd got decent value. I also managed to meet up, as I said, with a fair number of subscribers, made a couple of, more than a couple of really nice and useful contacts, various other historians and so forth. I got to see James May up close rather than from the other end of a gigantic stadium, which was interesting, although he did seem to be quite busy, so I kind of left him alone. And met up with Nicholas Moran, a.k.a. The Chieftain, who, as always, is a very, very nice chap and remains very tall. Also got to hear about the British Pacific Fleet from the head of the Royal Navy Historical Branch, which is not something you can say you do every day. And apologies for this picture because, well, I was at the back of the audience, as you can see here, but this was a very interesting talk on the big wing tactics of the Battle of Britain, led by a rather wonderful gentleman who had spent his entire career as a RAF fighter controller, and therefore knew a thing or two about the practicalities of managing fighters in the defence of the UK. But as well as all that, I also managed to record a couple of videos. Firstly, I came across a unit that people may not have heard of, the Royal Navy Beach Commandos, and that is separate to the Royal Marine Commandos. Do not get the two confused. So first, we're going to hear from them about their history and this unusual connection to HMS Warspite. And then we're going to go on to a game system which I ran across, which I found very intriguing, known as Brixkrieg, if any of you have heard of it. Although I actually recorded the Brixkrieg one first and the Commandos one second, so you're going to hear me lead in basically out of order. Sorry about that, but I just thought this order works slightly better for this video. Okay, hello everyone. This is the second video I'm shooting at We Have Ways Fest. So obviously we managed to find the Navy, lots of tanks and so forth, but this is the Royal Navy Commandos.
Yep, so we're Royal Navy Beachhead Commando reenactors. The Royal Navy Commandos were trained as commandos, clues in the name, but they were trained to run the beaches on Allied amphibious landings in North Africa, Europe, so Italy, Sicily, and Northern Europe, as well as into Burma and the Far East. So logistics, bringing ships to the shore in the right order, and as the order changes, getting those instructions as to what had to come into what beach and when, but also running the beach itself because there was an order in which things had to go off the beach to expand the beachhead.
Mm-hmm. And this is a new organisation for World War II.
Absolutely, yeah. Yeah. So you had a Royal Naval Division in World War One, and at the start of World War Two, once we'd sort of rallied a bit from Dunkirk, we realised we had to get back into Europe, and the way that was going to happen was primarily through amphibious assault. And they trained up Navy shore parties into what they called beach bricks. They had a system for managing the beaches, ships to the beach and assets off the beach. They tried it out at some of the early raids into Europe. Dieppe is probably the one that everybody will know. And they learnt pretty soon that those Navy sailors were getting a kicking. They didn't have the autonomous fighting skills and organisational skills to be able to carry it off properly. So they put them through the all-arms training course, trained them up as commandos, and then they did their beach assault training, their beach handling training, and went into theatre. First action, probably Diego Suarez on Madagascar, then across along North Africa. Torch would be the big operation that people have heard of in North Africa, and then Husky, so into Sicily, Italy, Salerno, Anzio, places like that. We although we tell the whole story of the Royal Navy Beachhead Commandos, we nominally portray N Commando, red lanyard, and they went up Italy, both sides of Italy in the end, and their time in theatre finished up really in the Adriatic, probably going across to the eastern side of the Adriatic, Yugoslavia, places like that, for more low-key operations.
Okay, and the beach masters these days are the descendants?
Absolutely. So I'm portraying a Royal Navy Beachmaster. They were generally quite a junior rank, anything from a sub-lieutenant through to a lieutenant commander. By the end of the war, maybe commander. But generally, they were quite a low commission, usually reservists, hostilities only commissions. But the Beachmasters existed then. At the end of the war, the Royal Naval Commandos were wrapped up, and the whole amphibious assault role was passed over to the Marines as an organisation. And they have their Beachmasters now. If you look at a 1950s amphibious landing pamphlet, it's virtually the same as the Royal Navy one, but they've crossed out Royal Navy and put Royal Marine in.
Fair enough. And just looking around the encampment, I'll just switch the camera head around. So we've got a little cache of weaponry here. Now, some of this is fairly obviously Lee Enfields,
absolutely,
various patterns.
Absolutely.
Standard British weapon. But we've got these things that look a little bit like Sten guns, but they have really nice woodwork on them, so they're obviously not. So what are we looking at with these?
Okay, let's take one out of the box here. So these are Lanchester submachine guns. Mm-hmm. And this is the first British production submachine gun, made primarily for the Navy. A few went to the Royal Air Force for airfield defence, but the Navy loved them. It is a beautifully engineered piece of kit. 50 round magazine, 5 round per second rate of fire, so 600 rounds a minute if you can change the magazines fast enough. Initially they had a selector for semi-automatic or automatic. That was taken away and they just went full auto. It's a heavy lump, beautifully machined, and also designed to carry the World War One SMLE bayonet, which I'm sure you're all familiar with. So this gives you the reach of a German rifle with a more modern short bayonet, but it also makes a statement. The Royal Navy were still thinking they were going to have to maybe board ships and also go into parts of the world to, I'll say win hearts and minds, but probably control colonial uprisings in places where they probably didn't know what this is or what it meant, but there isn't a culture in the world that doesn't understand your intent with 2 foot of steel pointing at them. So it carried that bayonet. It was a heavy piece of kit. The army by this time was sold on the concept of the submachine gun and ordered a copy of the Lanchester, which itself is a copy of the MP28. And if I do that, there's your Sten gun. Okay, make it cheaply, put a skeleton stock on, and there's your Sten gun. And indeed, some of the parts are interchangeable. The magazine is interchangeable, and you can put this bolt in a Sten gun and vice versa. But the Navy eventually stopped having them because they were too expensive. They made 80,000 of these, I don't know, 16 million Lee Enfields. The Navy and a lot of the commandos went over to the Thompson submachine gun, which we're all familiar with, and mm-hmm. Ironically was more expensive than these, but we could get them under Lend-Lease.
And there's a cutlass floating around somewhere.
So the steel The steel bayonet on the Lanchester replaced the boarding cutlass and the 45, which was your Matlow's standard boarding weaponry. Okay, exactly the same thing. I've got ease of fire in confined space, and I've got a statement of intent. These were carried on ships, some ships right into World War II. There is arguably an account of them being used in the Altmark incident when Royal Navy personnel liberated prisoners from ships in Norway. I'll say arguably. Some people say it didn't happen. I'd like to think it did. But yeah, the Navy Cutlass. This is the most unglamorous bladed weapon you will ever see. It is a brutal hacking implement. It's not sharp. They were never intended to be sharp. It's designed to skewer you or smash your collarbone, crack your skull, break a wrist. It's not going to chop you in half. It's just going to break bones and poke holes in you.
Fair enough. And there was one other rifle that's floating around, which has a very special connection that we were talking about earlier.
This is a P-14 rifle. This one is made by Eddystone, but they were made by Remington, Winchester and Eddystone. I was talking to a Royal Navy veteran that we've known for a long time called Archie Thomas. And Archie was within Commando initially. And I said to him, did he have the SMLE or did he have the more modern number 4 Mark 1 Lee Enfield? He said, oh no, I had a Remington. Off I scuttled. Got onto the internet. Found out about these rifles. Made at the end of World War I, when the British military were considering converting to a Mauser actioned rifle, which is what this is. The second half of the production was in the 303 ammunition, unlike the P-17, which looks the same but has a 30-06, I think, or 30-08 round. This was the 303 version. So this rifle could have seen service at the end of World War I. It was very much favoured as a marksman's rifle, which is why some of the Navy commandos, they trained with these, but generally they were issued the Lee Enfields, but some of them, the naturally gifted marksmen, hung on to these because it gave them a couple of hundred yards more accuracy. So this rifle could have seen service in World War One. And I was chatting to somebody at a show like this, and I tend to hold the rifle like this when I'm talking to people, and he said, why have you got a hammer and sickle carved in the stock of the rifle? And if you look there very closely, once you've seen it, you can't not see it. And turns out that a lot of these, once we got production of the Lee Enfields up and running, a lot of these went out to Russia as lend-lease, and the Russians were renowned for personalising the charity they'd had to take in a way. It's possible it went to Yugoslavia with the communist partisans there, but generally they didn't give their rifles back, where the Russians gave everything back at the end of the war. So could have seen service in the First World War, could have seen a bit of service in Britain at the Second World War, and could have seen service with the Russians. Came back, and on the bottom of the bolt is engraved a name, Miss Gienart.
Yeah.
Okay. So I was telling this story at this show a couple of years ago, explaining that it could have been the First World War, gone to Russia, was given probably as a target rifle to Miss Gienart, or owned by Miss Gienart as a target rifle, and someone said, oh, I knew Miss Gienart. I had a bit of a wobbly moment. And he sent me a magazine article. So Miss Gienart was one of the founder members of the Women's Rifle Association, which was kind of a women's home guard. It was women that already knew how to shoot, formed themselves into an organisation, and they were going to help if we were invaded. They were going to be the ones, you know, assisting the home guard with their target shooting skills. And she was in the South London Gun Club based at Bisley. And a very, very dear friend of hers gifted his favourite rifle to her, which we much, much admired, which was a guy called Admiral Francis Patrick Hutton. Admiral Hutton was the commander of Warspite at Salerno, which we portray as N Commando on the coast of Italy. So it came full circle. And also Hutton had actually been a commander of Hermes as well. So very rare you get provenance on these things. And if these things could talk... But yeah, we've got a magazine article which specifically references this rifle, and it has his initials in the identity disc on the bottom. After a few years of trying to work out what unit this was, it turns out it was his initials. So a lovely old thing, has a beautifully smooth trigger release, and we think it was probably tuned as a target rifle. And it's got Fulton and Sons stamping on the barrel, so it was worked after the war by gunsmiths at Bisley.
Excellent. So living connection to HMS Warspite can be found with the RN Commandos here. So just very briefly to wrap up. So we've got the rest of the encampment here. You've been here Friday, the day Saturday. You're going to be here tomorrow as well.
Absolutely.
We're over, just in case, by the food section.
Yep.
If anyone wants to come and have a look, although by the time this goes up, it's probably a bit late, but there you go. So where else can people see your group or get involved if they want to?
So if you Google Royal Navy Beachhead Commando Reenactors, you'll find us. Mm-hmm. We are looking to recruit some more people, particularly youngsters. We want to bring youngsters into the organisation. We've got a new member with us today who's 19. It's his first show. He's having an absolutely great time. We're primarily based in the south of England. The depot, if you like, is Kent, but we've got members in South Wales, Portsmouth, Surrey, Hertfordshire, Buckinghamshire, and a bunch of us in Kent. Good bunch of guys, but we're absolutely mad keen to tell the story of the Royal Navy Commandos. They're little known. They were an absolute linchpin in all the Allied landings, and their story really needs to be told.
Right, well, thank you very much for lending me your encampment and your time. And if you want to learn more about the RN Commandos, now you'll know where to go and either find them at events.
Facebook page,
when they're not at events. It's an absolutely wonderful encampment you've got here, and thank you very much for your time.
My pleasure.
Right, hello everybody. A little bit unusual today. We're at the We Have Ways Fest on Saturday, and the weather is not what they forecast, which is good, because it was forecasting horrible amounts of rain. So we're here with Brix Krieg, which I really like the name first off. You're the creator?
Yeah, I'm Tom, I'm the owner. So my brother and I came up with the idea. Mm-hmm. And we currently run it and try to really keep up with what has been amazing demand. So it's been a really great couple of years.
Mm-hmm. Right, so let's take a look. We've got a demo table, so I'm just going to flip the camera around and drop in. Right, so we've got this demo table set up in what looks like, so this is set up at the moment, Germans versus British. Mm-hmm. So what I think everyone's going to immediately realise is this is not Lego, but compatible.
No. Exactly right. Yeah, they're the same bricks, but not made by the famous European company. Yeah,
fair enough. This is a tabletop war game. You've got the terrain is bricks. You've got the men are mm-hmm. bricks. You've got the tanks are bricks. And one of the things when I came by yesterday and saw this, I actually thought it's really cool. You've managed to get recognisable tanks. So these are obviously Churchills.
Yep.
These are obviously Panzer IVs. Mm. And earlier there were some Tigers out, and they're very obviously Tigers. So how have you managed to do that on this kind of scale? Because this is not large for a brick model.
No. So the scale came about because I wanted to make a war game, and obviously they take up space. So it's about 15 millimetres or 1 in 100, depending on whether you're wargaming scales or modelling scales. And really the fun, the joy of creating the vehicles is to try and find that one key shape that defines what you're trying to build. So again, the Churchill's tracks is key, the covered tracks, mm-hmm. and then you've got the Piats, which that one piece that makes the end of the Piat has that little spiky bit that is so obviously what it is. So it's great fun, and we also have loads of amazing guys and girls in our fan base who then take these mm-hmm. and make even cooler things with them. So it, part of the fun is definitely finding new ways to make these key shapes with just a handful of bricks.
Yeah, and I suppose for terrain-wise, I mean, you could do any kind of terrain. You know, blue bricks, mega blocks, Kobe, Lego, whatever. You can build whatever you like. If you want to have a World War II battle in the middle of the Marvel universe, there's nothing stopping you from doing that.
Absolutely. One of the guys who bought some stuff off us quite early on sent me some photos of him playing with his two children, the quite young children, and his battlefield was made of a petrol station, half a pirate ship, and I think there was a unicorn somewhere. but just made from Lego sets that his kids had about. And again, we have some really simple rules, that we provide in our Battle in a Box. Lots of people play their own rules, which of course is great, but our really simple rules are also designed so that younger people or people who've never played before, within an hour, they should be able to get to grips with how it works, and they should be able to enjoy it. So,
and speaking of the rules, so you get these little cards?
Yep. So they've got the sort of the simple statistics, so how far they move, and then a little bit how far they shoot, how many shots they get. So you'd get one of those for each unit on the table, and then that just helps you. If you've got, for example, the Churchill has heavier armour than the Panzer.
Yeah.
So the cards would show that.
Mm-hmm. And then I think one of the things that attracted me to this when I was looking at it is I was thinking, you know, with the best will in the world, and people who view my channel regularly will know, I do play various tabletop war games. But when you end up buying your average tabletop war game, you end up investing about as much as you spent on the models in paint and glue, and then probably about as much again in carrying solutions, because if your third of a millimeter thick gun barrel or mast or landing gear snaps, that's it, good luck putting it back together. Whereas with this, it's like, okay, a little bit of bubble wrap, and if the turret falls off, it's like, oh no, whatever shall I do? Oh, I just put it back on again.
Absolutely, and that's, I mean, the birth of the idea really came from, I wargamed when I was young, and then wanted to start playing again a few years ago, and was speaking to my brother, and I looked at the cost, and I've never been a modeler. I'm not very good at painting and modelling, and never have been, and so this really appealed, because I could get a relatively big army, so straight to tabletop army, that I could put together in under an hour. And as you say, I could, you know, if it got dropped or I didn't use it for 4 months, or so it was born out of my lack of talent, really, for painting and modelling. But
and you've got some customization, like this commander's got his head out.
Yeah, absolutely.
And I suppose if I suppose that's the other thing. I was just thinking, you know, if you're playing the game and one of my tanks gets destroyed, I'll pop the turret off. Or
yeah,
if you want to get really ambitious, you say, oh, Hulk smash.
Yeah.
Oh, well, I'll put it back together at the end of the day.
Absolutely. And you can get, you can take whatever bits you want off, which means if you wanted to use some more advanced rules and you wanted to disable a tank, you could pop a track off if you wanted to. So it's hugely flexible. And again, without a doubt, one of the nicest things to see is people who get into the idea, they buy some of the bits, and then they do great things with them, which is pretty unique for modelling.
And speaking of the range, so come over here. So we've got a whole load. So we've got some Sturmgeschütz. We've got, I think that's what, Panzer II or
Panzer II. Yeah, yeah.
Got the what I call the Skudsworth bit, because it's unpronounceable.
Yeah, I can't pronounce it either. I just use the number. SGKFZ.
Got the Stukas. There's the Tiger I mentioned earlier. Mm-hmm. And then coming over to the Allied side, we've got a Valentine, Universal Carrier, some Matilda, Shermans, obviously. Mm-hmm. Great proliferation. And I think this is the thing. It's again, as people who watch the channel know, I'm a naval historian, but I'm looking at this and I can identify 90% of what's going on, even though it's small bricks, brick models. So, and then obviously you've got all the your individual units. You've got the battle boxes.
Yep. So that's the starter set. That's designed for someone who maybe has not played before. Two armies in there, allies, Germans, and they've got a little bit of everything along with dice, tape measure, you know. So you literally can open that. We might have a go in the tent later if we...
And then we've got some additional specialist bits. It's got HMGs, PAC 38s. There's the Piats you mentioned. A 25-pounder battery, I like that. Universal carrier. And you've got a little D-Day setup going.
Yeah.
So... Is this a special scenario for the event, or
no? So this, again, as with most of this, was made for my benefit. So I made the D-Day War because I wanted to play a D-Day landing for the 80th celebrations last year, or commemorations. So I made it for me, and then I put it on the shop, and I thought, well, no one will buy that. It's quite expensive, a lot of bricks, and we keep running out of stock of it. So it's great, but as with most of this stuff, I built it because I wanted to play with it, and
And so how often, I suppose, if people wanted to start collecting this. Obviously, there's a range here. Mm-hmm. There's more stuff online. How often are you updating, adding new units, that kind of stuff?
So we have something new coming out pretty much monthly. Mm-hmm. So we had our latest release was, we've run out already today, but we had an Eastern Front box set. Mm-hmm. So that's got our Russians, Germans. So we've got KV-1s, T-34s in that. And then literally arrived at HQ before we left are the KV-2s, which is, you know, a hilarious mm-hmm. vehicle.
Yeah. But
the KV-2 and the 85mm version of the T-34, so slightly later war. And yeah, and we're always, Toby is one of our designers working hard here, and he's just in the process of doing some aerial support for the Russians. There's a Typhoon coming and various other exciting bits and pieces, so there's always something new coming out.
And I know, I'll just switch the camera back around again. So I know we've talked about, just before we started running this, we started talking about a potential naval expansion, because of course I would talk about a potential naval expansion.
Of course.
And you mentioned that obviously one of the issues is you can make a pretty recognisable half-track UC carrier, Tiger, etc. from bricks, but ships are a bit more complex because they are so much larger. So you either end up yeah. with generics at very small scale, but recognisable, so now it's become really expensive. And you know, some of us collect the Kobe models. I'm not necessarily sure we've got the floor space to play a full tabletop war game with them.
No, absolutely.
So is that something you're looking at in the future?
Yeah, definitely. So we're looking at the possibility of an aerial game. Mm-hmm. So we've already got some planes, so we're looking at putting together a rule set that can see them used. In terms of the ships, as we mentioned, definitely the challenge is to keep the principle of being able to look at it and go, oh, that is a class, whatever, destroyer or a frigate or whatever, or even a named ship, you know, particular. So making them familiar without, as you say, making them either prohibitively expensive or just too big to game with.
Yeah.
But there's always, so one of the things we're looking at potentially with the aerial, which may well work on the naval as well, is the possibility of having essentially one large model, so a bomber or a... And then essentially the mission is to destroy that larger model, which is a centerpiece. So we're definitely always looking at new ways to play the game using similar principles. But it sounds like we might just have a naval consultant.
Yeah, fair enough. Yeah, I'd be happy to help.
Help us to build some recognisable ships.
And I know we were talking earlier, we were talking about Bricklink Studio is a good way of, like, prototyping without actually having to have the bricks. So maybe that's a challenge for you guys out there, viewers. You know, break out Bricklink Studio. It's free as far as
I'm aware. Absolutely.
So you know, see if you can put together a recognizable profile of maybe a cruiser or a battleship in as few bricks as possible, because obviously the smaller it is, the more ships you can have on the table, and more, as I said, the more affordable it is. And that maybe that'll give us an idea of how small you can actually go while retaining, that's definitely that.
Absolutely, that would be brilliant.
Rather than just, this is a battle, you know, at that point you're actually playing the game of battleships, where this is 4 bricks long, this is 3 bricks long, that kind
absolutely.
Of stuff.
Yeah.
So going back to here, so obviously one of the things with tabletop wargaming, it sometimes is, it can be hideously expensive. Mm-hmm. There's the whole meme of like, oh yeah, Henry Cavill's just signed a new movie deal, he can afford half of a 40k army now. So talk me through the price point here. So if I want to get started in this, what's it going to cost me to get a starter set, and what's it going to cost me to upgrade with various fancy bits and pieces?
So the starter sets are £65. And that's the same as the Russian one. Mm-hmm. And on the back, it gives you some idea what's in it. You can check it out at the website. Again, it's got a full list of everything that's included and what to expect. And then the individual units and add-ons can go from something like heavy machine gun, which is sort of 3 bases of heavy machine guns, about £5, up to some of the larger tanks, Tigers, Churchills, they're £8. So... we also online sell multiples. So here we've only got one in a box, but we sell units of three. So again, there's a saving there as well. They're sort of £15-16 for a unit of three of any of the tanks. And so
I mean, that's pretty reasonable, to be honest, because I mean, how many war games do you pay single-digit pounds for anything?
Yeah,
to be perfectly honest.
Yeah, well, I mean, that, again, that was definitely part of the plan, was to make it accessible in every way. So, you know, it's not only that they're easy to build and they're robust, the rules are really simple and quick to get into, but it also was really important that it felt affordable, so that you could get a fun-sized army and start playing. So,
Right,
that's the aim.
Well, I think this shows a great deal of promise. Obviously, I'd really like to see a naval expansion for obvious reasons.
Of course.
But I think I'm definitely going to pick some of this up myself now. You guys out there, if you happen to run into me at an event like this, let me know in advance, because if you're a fellow Brixkrieg player, this is the kind of thing I literally can carry in a backpack, and then we just break out on the lawns or something and start playing away merrily without worrying too much about it. I'm really attracted to the durability of it compared to some other systems where you have to say you have to panic and fort knock your models just to not have them in a billion bits when you get to the other end.
Yeah.
So thank you very much.
Not at all. Thank you.
And check out Brixkrieg. There's a couple. You've seen the QR codes floating around. There'll be some links in the video description. And this is one of the many things we found at We Have Ways 2025. See you later, guys.